Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
See now, wasn't that easy? All you had to do was take the whole European economy right up to the brink, and then you make a deal. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Make it a working lunch. Listen to the Marketplace Midday Update podcast for the day's top business headlines. Subscribe on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcast.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Monday, the 25th of March. Good, as always, to have you with us. All right, so it wasn't written in stone exactly, but odds were pretty high that some kind of deal on Cyprus was going to get done this weekend. And lo and behold, it did. One big bank there is going to be shutting down. Big depositors are going to take it on the chin. And probably economic life in Cyprus is going to get worse before it gets better. Faisal Islam is the economics editor for England's Channel 4 News. He's been in Cyprus for a week now. Faisal, it's good to have you with us.
Hi, Kai.
Tell me, where have we tracked you down? Where are you right now?
I'm in a hotel in Nicosia, the capital of Cyprus. I mean, I came here about 8 days ago, and I never in my life would I ever have expected to witness the types of things that we're seeing in a kind of Western European economy. I mean, you're talking a return to a cash economy, but without any cash.
Yeah. Tell me what it's been like the past, 18, 24 hours. Not so much the last week or so, but now that there's word of a deal, what's the mood?
There's kind of anger, bewilderment, a lack of kind of clarity from the government about what's going on, a lack of clarity as to actually exactly who's running things. And so in the past 24 hours, there was real concern, literally, as to whether people would have enough cash for basics. Question marks about whether ordinary debit card and credit card transactions work. It's basically down to shops as to whether they want to risk getting repaid from the electronic payment systems. Some of them are willing to take that risk. Many of them are not.
Do Cypriots realize, not to put too fine a point on it, but the pain yet to come, right? Because now their financial industry has been cut in half or more. Their gross domestic product will fall, and they've had this trouble, and now there's more to come.
What gets lost is that there's also an ordinary, standard issue, painful fiscal adjustment ahead, spending cuts and tax rises. And that looks painful already on existing calculations done by the IMF and the European Union in Brussels. But what we had over the past week was a heart attack to the economy. I mean, you and I probably use the phrase, the economy has stalled. And I think I'm never going to use that phrase again, because I've literally seen what a stalled economy looks like, which is people stop, literally stop spending because they don't have any cash notes. It's extraordinary to witness. And all the equations that the IMF and the EU calculated the bailout on seem to be based on numbers which are completely irrelevant now.
Faisal Islam, the economics correspondent for Channel 4 News over in the UK. We got him in Nicosia. Faisal, thank you so much.
No problems. Thanks. Bye.
The good news, such as it is that the banks in Cyprus are set to reopen tomorrow. The markets, possibly, as well. Here is today's little-known American market fact of the day. The all-time NASDAQ high 13 years ago yesterday. And from the Marketplace desk of, wait, can he do that? This tweet out of Elon Musk this afternoon about Tesla, the car company that he owns and runs. Quote, really exciting Tesla Motors announcement coming Thursday. I'm going to put my money where my mouth is in a major way. Sure enough, ticker symbol TSLA, 4.5% bump just like that. The major indices didn't have it quite so good. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Remember the whole big thing when Apple launched the iPhone 5, how bad its maps were? The company's been trying to make amends ever since and at least make a respectable showing against Google. So in that vein, today Apple confirmed it's bought a startup called Wi-Fi Slam. It's an indoor mapping company, because the next frontier in navigation isn't using your smartphone to get from A to B. It's finding your way around inside B when you get there and making sure the marketers can, too. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore has that story.
Indoor mapping uses Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, even sensors inside smartphones to help you find your way inside a building. It can also help marketers find you.
There's been a secret, quiet but really furious research and development war going on behind the scenes.
That's Eric Bovee, VP of Business Development of Indoors, an indoor navigation tech company. He says Microsoft, Google, Apple, even cell phone manufacturers like Samsung and HTC are all trying to gobble up indoor mapping technology. And it kind of makes sense.
People spend 80% of their time indoors.
And there are times when having a map inside a giant airport or store could be handy for a consumer.
Really large IKEA is very maze-like, and, you're looking for a certain kind of pillow. Well, there will be an IKEA app with navigation.
But it's not just about navigation, it's about marketing. Imagine you're looking for that pillow in a department store.
The pillow is on the second floor. Go up the stairs and turn right. While you're at it, why don't you get a new sweater? I'm just saying. I actually feel bad for you because your sweater is so terrible. Here is a 10% coupon.
That's not totally far-fetched.
There's also the analytics component.
Tony Costa is a senior analyst at Forrester Research. Retailers are willing to pay to know where customers go, where they linger, so they can target ads, for example.
So they could measure when somebody got an offer when they're, say, for example, leaving for lunch. And when they were within the vicinity of a store, they would get an offer, and then they could track that person then coming into the store and seeing the success rate of those offers.
He says we have early examples. Walmart has an app to help you find what's on your grocery list and an interactive map that tells you what's on sale. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
On now to David Beckham, soccer star, underwear model, international ambassador for the game. Beckham, who until recently played for the LA Galaxy to try to pump some life into American soccer, just completed a trip over to China to try to do the same thing there. And if you think Beck's had his work cut out for him here, China's horribly corrupt soccer league, as our Shanghai correspondent Rob Schmitz reports, is just a whole nother ballgame.
The last time Chinese soccer fans saw the former chief of the country's national league, he was being led away in chains after receiving a 10-year prison sentence for taking bribes and fixing matches. Joining him in jail, the league's previous boss, the former national team captain, four other players on China's only team to play in the World Cup, and last but not least, China's most famous referee, Lu Jun, a man nicknamed Golden Whistle. The state of Chinese soccer couldn't be worse. Enter David Beckham.
I'm not a politician, so anything that has gone on in the past is nothing to do with me. But what is going on in the future will have something to do with me.
The new global ambassador for Chinese soccer followed through with his promise this weekend. He offered to take a free kick in front of the Chinese media wearing a designer suit. He slipped and fell on his butt. Images of Beckham taking a tumble were repeated on Chinese news stations, and China's soccer league was back to square one.
If I were David Beckham, I'd be careful about making any promises about the future of Chinese football.
Gadi Epstein, Beijing correspondent for The Economist, has written extensively about the problems with China's soccer league.
As Chinese economy has grown, as more money has gotten into the game, there's been more opportunities for match fixing.
Epstein says corruption is as big as a problem in China's soccer league as it is in its one-party system. On the street in Shanghai, a soccer fan who would only give his surname, Shen, says the state of Chinese soccer is immune to a mend-it-like Beckham approach. Shen says China's soccer system is so pathetic that fewer and fewer parents are pushing their kids to play the sport. Even though he's a soccer fan, Shen says he didn't pay attention to Beckham's visit. The only thing he'd heard about it was that Beckham had fallen on his behind. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
We heard a lot about no money down mortgages during the housing boom, people using them to buy houses they couldn't really afford. We all know how that ended, but get this, we're hearing about those kinds of loans again. This time around, really, really rich people using them to buy houses they can definitely afford. Sounds a little silly to skip a totally doable down payment and pay interest they don't have to, but it's actually an interesting gamble for those buyers and their banks. Marketplace's Mark Garrison explains.
Rich folks can do things regular people can't, like eat a banana split with Mountain Dew-flavored ice cream on their helicopter commute home, and land that chopper at a mansion they bought with no money down. That's right, no money down. For those rich enough, buying a home can be as easy as showing banks their money. All some buyers have to do is pledge their wealth as collateral instead of coughing up a down payment. NYU real estate finance professor Stan von Nieverberg explains the appeal.
Interest rates are historically low. At the same time, the stock market is doing really well. And some investors or some households are asking themselves, how can I profit from these low interest rates?
Here's how. Say wealthy buyers pay 3% interest on a mortgage. They don't have to divert their money to make a down payment. And if they leave it in investments that earn more than 3%, that difference is the profit.
If there are clients who have a high enough net worth, maybe for them, that's a good decision.
But Columbia real estate professor Chris Mayer is quick to add that there is risk. If the economy falters, rich borrowers could see their home and investment values drop, or adjustable mortgage rates could rise, eating up their profits. As for the banks, NYU's von Nieverberg says they're enjoying this new demand from the wealthy.
The banks are not trying to find new borrowers to lend to, and this is some loan business that, in their view, is pretty safe and they're happy to do.
Pretty safe because these borrowers have lots of money and a big house as collateral. The days of no down payment loans for speculators or people with weak credit are over. But there is a way to get a no down payment loan if you're not rich yet. You'll need a certain job, like this fellow, known for sweaters with patterns that positively scorch the eyes.
Oh, rap, you mean like, hey, my name is Cliff and I'm a doctor and I will sit and do the thing. Hey, bull, pap, hip, hip, hip.
If Cliff Huxtable came and started looking for a loan with us, we'd be delighted to lend to him.
Greg Wheeler is kidding, of course. You don't become president of the private bank at BOK Financial by handing over money to 80s sitcom doctors. But the bank does have a growing business in no down payment loans for real doctors, even those just starting out.
They tend to be very loyal clients, and we want to engender that loyalty and have them join as early as clients, and we keep them for a very, very long time.
Many banks have special mortgages for doctors who could be profitable customers over the years. No down payment loans may evoke memories of a swelling housing bubble, but in another form, they're a way for banks to snare some big money clients. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Coming up.
When the weather is bad, we actually seem to think more sharply and more clearly.
How the actual environment and some other things affect our decision-making. But first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, so much for that Cyprus bailout bump, huh? The Dow Industrials threw off 0.4% today, 64 points, closed at 14,447. The NASDAQ slipped 0.3%, 9 points, 32.35. The S&P 500 gave back a third of 1%, 5 points, ended things at 15.51. Financial shares took a hit. Citigroup slid more than 1.5%. Bank of America erased 1.2%. Morgan Stanley debited itself nearly 1%. The prospect of a bidding war over Dell pushed its shares higher. They were up 2.5% today. Elsewhere in the techosphere, if that's a word, who knows, Apple grew a third of 1%, Microsoft off a third of 1%, and BlackBerry, oh, it got fooled again with its new phone going absolutely nowhere. Shares fell another 4.5% today. Apollo Group, which owns University of Phoenix, booked a 7% gain on news it's going to buy back shares. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.92%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on sales of new homes for February. Are those homes filled with shiny new appliances? The Commerce Department also reports on durable goods orders for last month. And the Young and the Restless celebrates 40 years of drama. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. The Supreme Court takes up two high-profile same-sex marriage cases this week. Oral arguments tomorrow and Wednesday on California's Proposition 8 and the Federal Defense of Marriage Act. And with cases like these, as you know, people camp out in front of the Supreme Court building to wait in line and make sure they get a seat. Such a regular thing that there are businesses that supply line sitters for those who have better things to do. It is just one of the many small industries that have sprung up around the court, not the least of which is the business of bringing the cases themselves. Marketplace's Adrian Hill has that story.
Taking a case to the Supreme Court isn't cheap. Attorney James Bopp has argued many big deal cases in front of the justices. He says the first step is asking the court to consider your claim, which carries a pretty substantial lawyering price tag.
If you're just paying hourly and you're paying at D.C. rates, it would be somewhere from $100,000 to $250,000.
And that's just to ask the Supreme Court to hear your case. If the justices agree, which they rarely do, then we're talking really big numbers.
About the cheapest you can get away with at D.C. rates is $250,000, and then it ranges in the millions after that.
And those lawyer fees are only the beginning of the money that gets poured into Supreme Court cases. Stephen Engel teaches politics at Bates College.
When you think about the overall process, there's a lot of actors that are involved.
Experts who help prepare the case, the salaries of the justices, their clerks, their staff, the opposing lawyers, and costs of filing amicus, friends of the court briefs.
Each amicus brief, you know, needs to pay for the process of, you know, of all the staff and all the costs associated with the labor of generating that amicus brief.
Dan Ortiz from the University of Virginia School of Law says the same-sex marriage cases the court will hear this week are a little different when you're talking money.
I think that most law firms who are involved are not charging their full rate.
In part because they believe in the cause, but also taking part in these hot-ticket cases
makes you a real player in the profession and raises your profile for future cases.
Future cases that may have much bigger paychecks. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
In less than a year, Obamacare is going to be fully enforced. Millions of people who've never had health insurance are going to get it. And that is going to be a huge problem because we just don't have enough doctors, primary care doctors in particular. Estimates of the shortage bounce around maybe several thousand doctors today, as many as 50,000 by the middle of the century. It's a lot of ground to make up, but it's also an opportunity for medical professionals who aren't doctors to step in. From the health desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein has that story.
It's tough enough to see a primary care physician today. Just wait till next year when another 30 million people get insurance under Obamacare. Dr. Wanda Filer is on the board of the American Academy of Family Physicians.
We need all hands on deck. We need more family physicians. We need more primary care nurse practitioners. We need more physician assistants. Everyone with a focus on a patient.
And certainly, all those medical folks are only too happy to jump in. The country spends some $200 billion a year on primary care.
Does that hurt to touch it? I'm sorry.
No, it's all right.
Yeah.
Nurse practitioner Andrea Vittori is gingerly examining her patient's swollen calf. Vittori runs the Mary Howard Health Center in downtown Philadelphia, which books about 900 appointments a month.
You know what's really bothering me?
Vittori's patient has a nerve problem. It's outside her scope of practice, so she's referring him to a specialist. There's just no need for a primary care physician.
People talk about the future of healthcare and nurse practitioners filling the role of the primary care provider and physicians becoming the specialists. I don't see any reason why that couldn't be.
RAND Corporation health economist David Auerbach says there's good reason for primary care doctors to be looking over their shoulders. Nurse practitioners can treat 85% of what a primary care doctor can treat.
The number of primary care physicians, it's growing very slowly. And the number of NPs is going to something like probably double in the next 15 to 20 years.
All this isn't lost on powerful medical organizations like the Family Physicians and the American Medical Association. Those groups say providers should work together as a team, so long as physicians run the ship. Bring on the turf war.
Currently, there are 12 states with active legislation looking at utilizing nurse practitioners at the top of their education to meet patient care needs.
Tay Capanos works for the American Association of Nurse Practitioners. She says nurses want to end laws that require some level of physician oversight, like for prescriptions or diagnosis. Doctors say this isn't about stealing their jobs, it's about patient safety. What if there's a complex case and the nurse practitioner misses something? Dr. Artis Hoven is the president-elect of the AMA.
I see it as physicians being true to their oath and being true to their training. And I think most physicians in this country feel that way. They're not threatened by this. At the end of the day, what they want to do is deliver the best health care possible.
Dr. John Rowe at the Columbia School of Public Health says nurse practitioners are already working without primary care doctors.
The fact is, this is going on in 16 or 17 other states, and there's no evidence that it's not good for the patients.
As a doctor himself, Rowe gets why doctors feel threatened.
We may be dealing with a change in professional image. The physicians feel that they have something special to offer, and being told other individuals who can do it as well as they could is a very difficult lesson for them.
But Rowe says if doctors and nurses can't come together to solve the primary care shortage, that could be a painful and expensive lesson for all of us. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Seeing, they say, is believing. But the truth of the matter is that what you see sometimes isn't all there is. And the stuff that we don't know about affects our behavior in all kinds of different ways. Adam Alter teaches marketing and psychology at NYU. His new book is called Drunk Tank Pink. Adam, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
I must ask, and this can't possibly be the first time you've been asked this question, but Drunk Tank Pink, what does that mean?
That is a common question. Drunk Tank Pink. It's a color that psychologists used to paint the inside of jail cells in the late 70s and early 80s. And they stumbled on this fact that when you painted the inside of the jail cells this bright pink, bubblegum pink color, that the prisoners seemed to calm down.
Environment then matters. Is that the lesson?
Yeah, that's exactly right. One of the big factors is the colors around us. The environment matters in other ways as well, though. So the weather shapes how we think and feel. What's interesting about that is that when the weather is bad, we actually seem to think more sharply and more clearly. In one experiment in Australia, some researchers approached people in a small corner store. And just as they were leaving the store, they asked them to recall whether they noticed 10 small trinkets on the store counter.
Yeah.
And what they found was that people were much better at remembering what those trinkets were, about three times more accurate on the rainy or cloudy days than they were on the sunny days.
Which does... seem to lend itself to the possibility that a smart retailer or merchandiser would take advantage of these, you know, not fixing the weather necessarily, but painting a store a certain shade or playing some music or something?
Absolutely. I think that's one of the central messages in the book. It's not so much trying to encourage people to take advantage of others, but just to suggest to consumers that it's a good idea to understand what these cues are, what these factors are, because once you recognize what they are, you can then cope with them, deal with them, and sometimes even harness them to your benefit.
This must wreck your life. I mean, when you walk into Macy's or Bergdorf Goodman or Nordstrom or something, do you're like, oh, man, this is what they're doing?
You know, I have to turn off. Otherwise, life would be exhausting for me. One thing that helps me immensely is that I'm colorblind.
Oh, wow, yeah.
So that really helps. There's an irony there that I'm talking about this color pink that I actually can't really see. And so I like to think that I'm immune to some of these effects.
One of my favorite things about this book was this observation that people named Kim, Kate, and Kelly gave more to donate in Hurricane Katrina relief than people whose names began with other letters. And that just seems to me to be wild.
It is wild. It's incredibly surprising. And people are always surprised when they hear that, but there's pretty strong evidence for it. So if you look across a whole lot of different hurricanes, Hurricane Mitch, people named Mark and Mary would have given more. Hurricane Katrina, as you said, people with K names gave more. I think what's especially powerful about this is there are ways to harness the naming of hurricanes to increase giving. We know that there are many, many more people in the U.S. with J names and M names. And given we know that, why would we name hurricanes with O names or with V names as often as we do? And I did a quick calculation and found that over the last decade, if we'd named hurricanes appropriately.
Appropriately, that is to say maximizing returns, right?
Exactly, yeah. Maximizing returns. Picking the right initials, you could have increased giving by over $500 million.
Have you called the National Weather Service?
No, I haven't. But
Come on!
This is something I wrote on the back of a napkin the other day, and I think it's brewing, and I think it's time. It's time to call them.
Yeah, absolutely. Adam Alter, he teaches psychology and marketing at the Stern School of Business at NYU, New York City. His book is called Drunk Tank Tink. Adam, thanks a bunch.
Thanks very much for having me, Kai.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out, one at which I dare say pretty much everybody listening to this radio broadcast will shake their heads. Yahoo spent $30 million today to buy a news aggregating app, Sumly, it's called. Pulls the need-to-know stuff from news articles, makes it look nice on your iPhone. That's about it. And it's great and all, but here's the head-shaking kicker. Sumly was created by a 15-year-old kid to help him get through his homework. Nick D'Aloisio is 17 now. He's rich, and in case you're wondering, yeah, he totally gets to work at home. Come on, right? All right, that's Marketplace from 8 p.m. on this Monday. Today, the Dow off 0.4%, 64 points. The NASDAQ slipped 0.3%, 9 points. The S&P 500 gave back about a third of 1%, 5 points right there. Our producers include Bridget Bodner, Gina Delvac, Mary Dew, Nancy Fargali, Millie Jefferson, John Ketchum, Jolie Myers, and Chow Tu. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.